Your curiosity and awareness are showing, and it's great because today's guest, Dr. Pamela Popper, is diligently on the path of nutrition, medicine, and healthcare, and has some great information to share. Her book is Food Over Medicine, and it's a conversation that can enhance all of our lives. I'm Robin with Tributaries. Pam, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm always interested in getting the word out to new audiences, and I'm grateful for the opportunity.
Would you share a bit about your journey into healthcare? Has it always included the plant-based diet? How did your direction lead you into that?
Well, I'm probably the person most likely to not be where I am right now. I grew up in, there's just nothing in my background that hinted that I would end up being in the healthcare business or interested in nutrition at all. I graduated from high school, went to college, dropped out, couldn't really find anything that made me excited. And, you know, so I'm every parent's worst nightmare, no career direction, you know, the whole nine yards. Got a job, and I did pretty well. I ended up being really good at sales, and my last real job was as a sales trainer. I did that really well. But during the first 20 years of my adult life, I can't even begin to describe to you how bad my habits were. I mean, I lived on 3 pots of coffee a day, shortbread cookies, and cheese, and I mean, just a terrible diet, and I did not move for, I guess it's 20 years. I mean, I just didn't do any exercise at all. And I'd gotten quite chubby. I mean, people look at me right now and they never saw me when I was really kind of fat. And I was tired all the time. Fortunately, you know, I'm not one of those people that got cancer and nothing disastrous happened. But in that state and just kind of not knowing what to do about it, I ended up reading John McDougall's book, The Original McDougall Plan. Somebody loaned it to me. And I read that and I thought, oh my gosh, well, the first thing I got to do is fix myself. I mean, we talk about a wake-up call, you know. So I did, and I'm one of those all-or-nothing people. Not everybody's like this, but it's like, okay, I'm going to eat a plant-based diet. So I just jumped off the cliff. I wasn't vegan in the beginning, but definitely, you know, eating a little bit of fish and that's it. Everything else gone. And it took a while to get the diet right. Gosh, there were no online resources like you have right now. No shows like this. You had to figure it out on your own, you know. So I did, and I lost weight, and it was fabulous. I looked good. People were asking, oh, my gosh, what happened to you? It doesn't even look like you anymore. So that's how it all started. And then my interest, based on what happened to me, translated into a, gosh, maybe this is really what I want to do. First time I ever had any career direction in my life. So I got some education and started down the path, and here I am much later. So I'm a lucky person. I always tell everybody, I got to do this when I didn't have something life-threatening going on. That's great. And I've found something that I love doing so much, it's not like a job. So that's how I got here.
There's a lot with healthcare that is labeled as such, and yet it isn't quite. I would like to have you share just some thoughts on the state of food politics and the abundance of medical misinformation, and we can share that before we move into more about what you found about plant-based diet and what's going on.
Yeah, well, we have a lot of problems with food overall because we have a system that encourages the wrong behavior. And so I always call this good apples in a bad barrel. You know, people go into fields of, you know, nutrition and government service, and I think they all want to do good things, and then they end up working in situations that just lead to all the wrong places. So one of our big problems here in the United States is the United States Department of Agriculture, which is an organization formed, you know, authorized by Congress to help farmers. And I went back, I just recently read a book on this topic, and I guess it gave me a chance to remember that when the USDA was formed, farmers were in trouble. They didn't know how to irrigate. They were just plowing up the topsoil, and farming technology was terrible and backward, and a lot of hungry people in the United States. And so to the USDA's credit, they helped fix that problem, and everything would have been fine if they hadn't gotten into the Dietary Guidelines for Americans business, because you can't have an agency telling Americans what to eat and then have that same agency in the business of advocating for farmers, because it's a conflict of interest. They have to tell people, if they tell the truth, not to eat so much of things their constituents, the farmers, produce. And so you have this awful set of guidelines. It gets a tiny bit better every time due to the screaming and hollering of some great advocacy organizations like the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, but it's still, the recommendations are not very good. They're very misleading. And along with that, you've got a lot of government intervention in farming and subsidies, and we don't subsidize broccoli and chickpeas.
I've noticed.
Corn that we feed to livestock, and, you know, buying dairy at below market prices, and, you know, so we need a broccoli lobby, I think. Maybe that would help. But that's the problem with food. And then the FDA gets involved with all these silly claims that they allow, like you take a chocolate candy and fortify it with calcium and say that it's good for bones. And I'm not kidding. There's a product like that on the market. And, of course, everybody wants to hear that chocolate is good for your bones if it's fortified with calcium. I like that story, too. It's just not true. So, darn, right?
Yes. So
there are so many issues like this. I mean, I teach an entire course on this. It's 18 hours of lecture. Plus homework assignments. That's how much there is to talk about. So I think we can just conclude it's pretty messed up, and it's not going to get any better anytime soon, which means that people are getting wrong messages. Now, if you hop over to the health side, which is not very far away because diet has a profound effect on health, the bottom line is that probably 90-some percent of what we do in healthcare is not justified by evidence. And you heard that right. I mean, the third leading cause of death in the United States is health care, and that only counts deaths from people who are hospitalized, not deaths in people who were getting outpatient care that was bad or misguided and ends up killing them. Again, there are some marvelous doctors out there. I've had the privilege of getting to know a bunch of them through this type of work that I do, but the thought that, you know, you're going to get one of those docs by just opening up your insurance plan and seeing who's covered and seeing one of those docs is so remote. So our whole business here is, you know, revolves around informed decision making, that whether you're going to take a dietary supplement or adopt a new diet or have a screening test or take a drug or have a procedure, it is the consumer's responsibility to source information and make good informed decisions, because you can just assume that most of what you're being told is not correct. And when I say that, it sounds so bizarre compared to the way that we traditionally consume medical services, but what I'm really proposing to people is you start buying medical services the way you buy houses and cars and blenders and washing machines and contracting services, where you ask a lot of questions and you get knowledgeable enough, not so that you could put the deck on the back of your house or fix your own plumbing, but you know what you're signing up for and you know what it's going to cost and you know it's the right thing to do. We have messed up systems is what I'm talking about.
Yes, and certainly when you talk about, you know, how much it's going to cost, and you were referring to electrical or plumbing in your house. But in your book, Food Over Medicine, you really bring this up with what are the costs. They're hidden and they're phenomenally high when we can't take our own responsibility for this. And I was so pleased to see in your book that you have the chapters brought to us with a question and answer format. Managing your doctor is part of all of this. And talking about annual exams that have become standard practice. And to me, it's kind of like ever since the shoe bomber, we all have to take our shoes off at the airport.
Right. Well, the bottom line is that most of what we do that's standard practice, and most of what starts with everybody knows this is a good idea, actually isn't. And so the first thing that you do, and I always, here's your line of differentiation. If you're in an emergency type situation, you've been in a car accident and you have broken bones and you're bleeding, you really don't want to have a long discussion and start reading books and, you know, time out, I'm going to go look into this and I'll be back. I mean, that's when medicine in our country and in westernized countries really shines. We do marvelous work in the ERs and in the intervention business. But in the absence of that, when somebody says, I think you should adopt this diet, take this supplement, take this drug, have this procedure, have this screening test, the answer should always be, that's very interesting, I'm going to be looking into it. I'd appreciate it if you would give me some of the published articles that have made you think that this is a really good idea. I'd like to review them. I'm going to be checking into this on my own, and I'll be getting back to you and letting you know my decision. And again, this is the way people buy houses and cars. I mean, I've never had somebody pull into my parking lot here And I said, you know, that's a new car. Yeah, well, I hate it, but it's the one the salesman said I had to take. You know, people don't do that with cars. They are very diligent about the warranties, and they ask other people who own this car, what do you think? Have you been happy? Who'd you buy it from? You know, so more curiosity, less willingness to jump in, and what happens, the way the medical profession doesn't do this, even though the AMA actually has guidelines requiring doctors to do this, why they don't do this informed decision-making, risks and benefits and all that, is that when people are fully informed, their enthusiasm for most of what they're being told to do in medicine drops a whole lot. Now, I'll tell you what else happens, and this is really good news, is when people understand and see for themselves that much of what they're being told to do to address their symptoms and weight problems and all that sort of thing doesn't really work, they become remarkably open-minded about changing their diet, exercising, and doing the things that you and I would agree are much better approaches to health. But you sometimes have to take them through that informed process of seeing that the magic solution that's being offered that requires no work on your part. You don't have to think. You don't have to pay for it. You just pop a pill or get an injection or whatever it is they're proposing to do to you. It really doesn't work so well. And then the motivation to do something different gets higher. So the ineptitude of medicine is a silver lining, because if people start to know more about the ineptitude of medicine and the inapplicability of it, they are likely to do the things you and I would like them to do.
Exactly. And also, once one would start asking a few questions, just a little bit of information can have a very grounding effect, where there's probably a lot of fear motivating why the person is even at the doctor's in the first place.
Well, it's fear, and it's also habit. And the other thing, too, is a lot of why people are in the doctor's offices is disease mongering. You know, it used to be, when I was a kid, I think my parents were pretty attentive. They were not neglectful of my sister and I. But the only time you went to the doctor was when you were really sick, all right? We have people taking their kids to a doctor's when they have hangnails. I have people that think that any time they have a headache, oh, my gosh, I better go to a doctor and check this out. The medical profession's trained people to think that every symptom they have, however transient it might be, requires some type of medical attention, and that's how you get sucked into the medical mill. The other thing that has people hanging out with doctors a lot is disease mongering, where we take healthy people and examine them with all kinds of imaging technology and that sort of thing until we find something wrong, and then they have a reason to visit doctors on an ongoing basis. And so I teach by analogy because it's easy for people to understand. So let's think about it this way. I live in a house that's almost 30 years old. I've been there for 30 years, and I've taken pretty good care of it, but it's 30 years old. So think about if tomorrow I put something on my Facebook page saying, listen, about noon, I want any contractor in Franklin County where I live that does anything, electrical wiring, tile work, baseboards, basement work, landscaping, anything that you do, plumbing, I want you to show up, and we're going to go through 3,000 square feet of house, a full basement, and an acre lot, and see if we can find some work for you to do. And if you come up with something, my insurance company will pay you for it. I'd be under construction for the next 45 years. Right?
Yes.
Now, we all understand that that's distinctly different than calling a plumber when the sink is leaking. That's distinctly different than calling an electrician when changing the light bulb won't work in the fixture anymore. We've got to get a new fixture. I do that stuff all the time because in a 30-year-old house, you've got some maintenance to do. I had to have my sump pump replaced last year. I mean, these things happen. But you don't call contractors and tell them, find some work and I'll be happy to pay you. Actually, I don't even have to pay you, so it doesn't matter how much stuff you come up with.
Let's move into the plant-based diet. Was there a most compelling piece of information that gave you the evidence you needed, or was it a gradual process? What really threw you hook, line, and sinker into this plant-based diet?
It was a gradual process, but I think that the biggest thing was when I read McDougall's book. McDougall has always talked about the right diet for humans, and that diets are species-specific. And he talked about eating a diet like this could keep you lean and healthy, he just pushed all the right buttons in the book. And so my background was, I was a dancer and a model in a previous life, and so I had gone from being really lean, probably too thin actually, to being fat. I mean, I used to call myself chubby because doesn't that sound nicer? But really, I was fat. Let's just put it out on the table, right? So I looked like holy hell at my age and was fat. And I have terrible family diseases running my family. My grandmother had rheumatoid arthritis. Her mother did. My mother did. And so I'm looking at my family history. I'm looking at myself, you know, and I'm thinking, this is not what I want for myself. I don't want to end up like my grandmother, my mother, and other people. I want to live a long, healthy life. You know, that promise to me was really important. And I'd never thought of myself as an athlete, but you know, I started running and just a whole new image of myself emerged. And then, you know, once you're interested, once you take a step in the right direction, you tend to take more of them. So we have to sometimes meet people where they are. I didn't start out vegan. I became later on. That happened. But my interest in all of the issues related to eating a plant-based diet started to grow, ranging from the use of animals in medical training to the horrible farming type of, I mean, that we all agree, just farm practices that are horrible, to the scourge of heart disease and cancer and diabetes. I mean, just, and that's, I think, what pushed me over the edge to say, I think I want to make my living helping people understand this in the context of the bigger medical issue and do my part to change the world. So it was a gradual thing, and I think that's, we got to make sure we don't overwhelm people in the beginning and give them the chance to have the process, that go through the process that I did.
That's very important, and I'm happy to hear you speak about that, because there is no silver bullet. If you push someone too far, they're not going to get it on just about every single level. Let the habits that perhaps aren't the healthiest for us hang on for a little while if they need to. Eventually, they will drop away when things start shifting.
Well, there's an issue I think that we have to acknowledge that's really important, and that, and I went through this, okay? We all like to think we're smart. I thought I was pretty smart and educated, all right? So it's not that I thought that cookies and coffee were good for you, not that kind of thing, but I thought that medical care was pretty good. I mean, I did all the stuff they recommended, annual exams and, you know, vaccinations and all that kind of stuff, and I thought the American diet was pretty good. I knew I'd veered from it. I wasn't even eating the standard American diet. Mine was worse than that, which says a lot, but I thought the standard American diet was good, and, you know, milk builds strong bones and all that sort of thing. So my point is that nobody likes admitting that they're wrong, and people really hate when they feel like they've been taken advantage of, they've been lied to. It's really uncomfortable because it makes you feel stupid. It made me feel stupid. And so I think we have to let people gradually come around to that in a way that they don't have to acknowledge they feel stupid. You know what I mean?
There's absolutely,
just a
I do.
Coming to grips with it. Yeah, so that you can say, okay, I now realize what's happened, and I'm smarter now, so I'm going to make better decisions now, and I'm no longer beating myself up for being a moron, you know, and all that sort of thing. And so when we go too fast and we try to, you know, beat people over the head, and everybody's going to be vegan tomorrow morning, and you know, if you eat a slice of toast, you're going to die. I mean, sometimes I think we're a little too extreme in our approach, but along with that, we've just got to let people process this information and come to grips with it, because it is true that we have all been lied to by our government, by the drug companies, by the medical profession, by the food companies, and everybody will eventually come to being at peace with it and a tiny bit angry, which is great, because then they start telling others, but we got to get them to the place where they're not embarrassed about it. And I was embarrassed in the beginning, you know, very much so.
Can we cover a couple of very important and obvious health conditions that you have valuable insights to share? Let's start with inflammation. We'll just do a couple.
Yes. Okay. Well, and inflammation is a good one to pick because it's a factor in all the others. The common denominator of cancer and diabetes and allergies and autoimmune diseases and arthritis and you name it is inflammation. And there are many reasons for inflammation, including the fact that it's a normal immune response, like if you have an injury or something of that nature. But inflammation that causes damage comes from two big things. One is diet. A huge one is diet. And the reason is that animal foods, which people in this country and westernized countries eat a lot of, are very, very rich in something called arachidonic acid. And this arachidonic acid is a precursor to inflammatory hormones. And so it's one of the reasons why people who eat an animal food-rich diet end up with a lot of diseases, including a symptom of disease, which is inflammation. The other place that is a major source of inflammation is fat cells, which we used to think were inert and just kind of hanging around doing nothing, are actually metabolically quite active. And fat cells produce inflammatory molecules like inflammatory cytokines that also contribute to generalized inflammation. So if you are an overweight animal foods eater, you are most likely existing in a chronic state of low-level inflammation, sometimes high-level inflammation, and sooner or later, something bad's going to happen. And it could be arthritis or pain. It often is. It can be cancer, which is really serious, and you don't always survive that. You can survive some pain, but you don't always survive cancer. So inflammation is a contributor to all of them, and it's easily lowered with weight loss and the right diet.
Yes. And, Pam, what about blood pressure? And new blood pressure guidelines are seriously skewed, aren't they?
Well, blood pressure, this goes to the disease monitoring. It's a perfect one for you to bring up. So first of all, we have an epidemic of hypertension in this country, real hypertension, and it comes from several places. One is dehydration. That might surprise you. But your blood plasma is mostly water. When you don't drink enough water, that plasma shrinks and your vessels constrict, and it contributes to high blood pressure, and also your blood becomes more viscous. So you combine dehydration and eating a lot of fat, and you can really form some blood clots pretty easily. But having said that, we've gone from normal blood pressure is 120 over 80, 130 over 80. We used to tell people who were 140 over 90, you're a little high, but, you know, start watching your weight, exercise, that sort of thing. We're now medicating people at lower and lower blood pressures. We're declaring them patients. And here is the problem with doing that, and it's pervasive across all disciplines in medicine. The smaller the abnormality, the less likely you will benefit from medical intervention, and the more likely you will be hurt instead of helped. And so the new blood pressure guidelines have suggested that we do two things. One is we start drugging people at even less abnormal blood pressure. And number two, that we use more drugs and higher doses of drugs to treat people down to this new target. And the evidence is really quite clear. In fact, the studies that they cited, the SPRINT studies, where the SPRINT trial was the one that was the most influential in arriving at these guidelines, clearly showed that about 16 people out of 1,000 benefit from drugging the heck out of them. And the other 900 and some people, not so much. In fact, you actually direct evidence of harm for 23 people for every 16 you help. And in what universe is it okay to hurt 23 to help 16 and then assume that people taking as many as 5 drugs, the rest of the 900 and some people taking as many as 5 drugs is okay? It's not okay. And what it does is it contributes to our ballooning health care bill, not only because of the cost of the direct intervention, but the side effects of those interventions, which includes killing people.
I would love to hear you talk about a diet, for instance, the traditional diet of the tropics, avocado, coconut oil, and fish. How can that be an incorrect diet when people have been thriving on this since, I'll say, the beginning of time, but that maybe isn't correct?
Well, they haven't been thriving on it since the beginning of time. You know, let's just take coconut oil. I wrote a 5-page paper on coconut oil, and I checked out everybody's claims. And I went to I do this unusual thing called reading the study that they cite, which they hope you never do. So one study that supported coconut oil, this author, who's everybody would recognize his name, I won't mention it here, but one study that was an argument for coconut oil cited this group of Pacific Islanders that supposedly eat a lot of coconut oil. So I went to the original study, and actually they do eat coconut oil, not very much of it, and a great deal has been written about this particular group of people because they eat, in general, a very low-fat diet, much like Dr. Esselstyn would prescribe, and they are known for their excellent cardiovascular health. So it was just the opposite of what they said. Yeah, there's a little bit of coconut oil, but they're eating a ridiculously low-fat diet, not a high-fat diet. it. Then another study that they cited was a group in Indonesia who supposedly were eating coconut oil and thriving. And actually, this particular group of people are the most obese people in Indonesia and have high blood pressure. So the bottom line is that there's a lot of misinformation out there from people who appear to be credible, who sometimes make themselves look even more credible by citing research studies. And of course, everybody assumes that those studies are accurate, but it's amazing how many times I go back and read the original study and find out, gosh, this doesn't say what this person is saying at all. So there are no populations that are living on the types of diets that some people are proposing and thriving. And so let's go to, let's talk about a couple foods specifically. Coconut oil is mostly saturated fat, and it's pure liquid fat, 14 grams of fat per tablespoon. Avocado has 21 grams of fat per cup, 21 grams. So it is virtually impossible to stay lean while you're eating this type of fat-dense diet. And even if you get away with it from a weight perspective for a period of time, your arteries are not thriving with this kind of fat, because we know that atherosclerotic plaque is made of not only saturated but mono and polyunsaturated fat. So I think that people are quite surprised to find that the folks who they think are eating all this fat are not, and the ones who really are, like the Inuit, have horrible health problems. The Maasai, for example, they eat a very high fat, high meat diet. Their average age at death is 42. Is that what we want to sign up for? I'm 61. I'm planning to be here for 40 more years. I don't think the Maasai diet's the one I want to adopt. I don't know about you, but not for me.
Yes, I understand. Is it difficult for you to get people to understand silver bullets in healthcare don't really exist?
I don't think it's difficult. I think we have to go about it in the right way. You have to show people evidence. And here's what makes everything sideways, and it's one of the reasons we conduct our business the way we do. Everything involves citations, and we teach people how to read medical research, because if you don't do that, then here's what the discussion is like. People say, well, I read this, and somebody else says, I read that, and my expert says this, and somebody else's expert said that, and my cousin's brother's neighbor's father-in-law says you should eat a paleo diet, and the person responds, well, my next-door neighbor's stepdaughter's great aunt says something different, and it's he said and she said, and these circular arguments. And so what you have to do is you have to first establish some rules of evidence. All research articles aren't equal. All experts aren't equal. So we got to decide who we're going to listen to based on some criteria. We're going to decide how we're going to filter evidence based on some criteria and teach people how to think. And we teach our people here to say, not just to question their doctors, give me some information, I'll be looking into it too, but when the neighbor says you should eat a paleo diet, really, please give me the research articles that you've been reading that tell you that this is a good idea. I'd like to see them. Well, do you think the neighbor has read any research articles on the paleo diet? Probably not. End of discussion. We stop this nonsense of, he said and she said, and I heard this doctor on YouTube and she said. And I mean, YouTube and the Internet and all this, good places to get information, but that's not who you quote when you're trying to convince somebody of something.
Understood, yes. I was both surprised and happy to see that you serve on the President's Board for the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine in D.C.,
yes.
Are you an outlier on that board?
In what way?
With your ideas about healthcare, for one.
No, I think that there's a great deal of agreement. I think that there's a different focus. In other words, I love TCRM. They've carved out a different realm than we have here. What they're doing, first of all, is they're working on shaping up medical training, and they've gotten animal training out of medical schools in America. And I can't tell you how important that is. I mean, if you have a six-year-old child who's choking, do you want the doctor who saved your child's life to have practiced on kittens or something that looks like a human? I think you're going to guess something that looks like a human, like a mannequin. They've been very involved in legislation to protect great apes and chimps and primates who are used in animal testing. First of all, because it's a terrible practice, it doesn't really lead to any great discoveries. And the second thing is we're talking about animals that are so intelligent that they can use sign language to say things like, I don't want to be in your study, leave me alone, where's my mother? You know, the fact that we subject these animals to cruel experiments is just beyond my comprehension. It's like doing it to a two-year-old. And then doing a lot of research in the areas of diet and pain, diet and diabetes. I mean, I rely on PCRM's evidence here every day when I'm talking to people. So we're in the informed medical decision-making business. They're in the research and advocating for animals and advocating for change in education and that sort of thing business. It's a little bit different mission, and the two are really, really interrelated.
Yes, and I thank you so much for bringing that committee to my awareness. Pam, is there anything you would like to say in closing to our audience?
Yeah, I'll tell you, I always like to end on a hopeful note, and I think things are changing. We certainly have a lot of work to do, but one good thing is the internet connects everybody, and it's easy to find information. It's how we find each other. It's how you and I came to be talking. And all the great documentaries coming out, those are being produced because people are interested in watching them. Every restaurant in Columbus, Ohio serves healthy, plant-based meals. You don't just go to vegan restaurants for good food now. You can eat almost anywhere and get good food. So I could go on, but I think that the problem is solvable because the awareness is becoming higher and higher, and more people are waking up and saying, I got to do things differently.
Dr. Pamela Popper, her book is Food Over Medicine. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, or sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasting is at iTunes as Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.